Good evening. It is 6 p.m. in the capital of the United States of America, Washington, D.C., and you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, political scientist, author, and nationally syndicated columnist, Dr. Wilmer Leon. For the next hour, we will explore and analyze the salient news stories that are impacting the global village in which we live. The family of Antoine Rose Jr., the unarmed teenager shot to death in June by an East Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania police officer, Michael Rosefeld, has filed a lawsuit against the borough. Rose, 17, was shot while running from a car that was pulled over by Rosefeld after a reported drive-by shooting in another area. The lawsuit alleges wrongful death and other counts against the borough itself, Rosefeld, Mayor Louis Payne, and Police Chief Lori Frunzek. For more insight into the suit and other related issues, we turn to my first guest. He is the attorney representing Rose's family, Fred Rabner. Attorney Rabner, welcome back to the Critical Hour.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
What are you alleging in the suit?
Well, right to the point, right?
Absolutely. Your time is valuable, sir.
Exactly. The bulk of the allegations, let's not lose sight of what really this case is about. The bulk of the allegations are really just about the same gravitas as that criminal matter is about, which is essentially Michael Rosefeld and his actions that night. So let's not lose sight that it's about a shooting of an unarmed teen who was running away, not towards an officer, causing no risk or harm to the officer or any other individual. So that's the bulk of the case. So it hasn't changed in that regard. But when you talk about it in a civil setting instead of a criminal setting, when last we talked, I think we talked about it in the criminal setting.
Correct.
But in the civil setting, you're talking about whether or not on the night in question, Michael Rosefeld's actions were reasonable when you consider the facts available to an officer then and there prevailing. And what we're saying is that no officer would have acted this way. It's not reasonable to have shot someone in the back from 30 feet away.
Instead of using the standard reasonably prudent person standard, you're using the reasonably prudent officer standard.
Yes, that's the way the law reads, and the case law that's been established talks about what a reasonably prudent officer would do under the circumstances then and there prevailing. And they look at the totality of the circumstances. So while it's obvious that they will be able to introduce in the defense of this cause of action certain factors that might have been in the officer's mind, they do look at the totality. And I think the key point that will really carry the day in that regard for the unreasonable use of force and deadly force is because when you use deadly force as an officer, you can't do so carte blanche. You have to follow the guidelines. And one of the major guidelines talks about using deadly force, and it talks about whether the officer gave a fair warning and whether that warning had an opportunity to be heeded. And in this situation, there's already clear evidence established on the record. I say the record, I mean the witness who was there and videoed the incident, saying that the officer said nothing at all and that the shots rang out boom, 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 right as he ran. So we know for a fact he gave no warning at all prior to using deadly force. So that's the first key element.
You talk about guidelines, but isn't one of the factors here also that there's a lack of policies and procedures for training officers in the borough?
Yeah, and I appreciate you bringing me to that point, because we've talked about Michael Rosefeld and his behavior, and I just didn't want to take the eye off of the ball, which is essentially, this doesn't happen without the acts of Michael Rosefeld being unreasonable. But what you're talking about is what I've been talking about as the fish stinking from the head down. We've sued the administrators as well, the mayor, the police chief. And why we've done that is because, just as you said, the policies and procedures were not there. Just this East Pittsburgh Police Department had no policies and procedures. In fact, we were told by the district attorney when we met with the family that they have no codified standard operating procedures. And how could you have trained an officer on proper protocol if he wasn't even trained on any codified standard operating procedures? But more importantly, we also allege not only did they not have proper procedures, And that goes from the mayor to the police chief down. But also, there was no vetting process. We're arguing that the hiring process was also flawed, because if you screen or vet your officers, you would have known about this dark past that Officer Roosevelt had when he was with the University of Pittsburgh Police Department, where we know that he assaulted many individuals, and we don't have all the details. That's actually part of this lawsuit. We want to find all those details. We'll quickly ask for, once we serve all the parties of this lawsuit, first thing we're going to ask for is the personnel file of Roosevelt from his previous employers. We're going to see all of the reports regarding the prior assaults that he had with other individuals that have been hinted to and spoken to us off the record by other officers. But that vetting process is a double-edged sword for the East Pittsburgh Police Department in the lawsuit, because either they didn't vet him at all, or they vetted him and knew about this and still hired him. They can't win either way on that regard.
How can a police department not have policies and procedures? Even Barney Fife in Mayberry had to follow guidelines and procedures.
Yeah, that's why we're not surprised that after 90 minutes on this, when you take into consideration, Wilmer, this officer's past history of violence, when you take into consideration that he wasn't properly vetted, when you take into consideration there was no standard operating procedure in East Pittsburgh, even though, and I don't know if you understand this, let me try to express how small this police department is. They only have about 10 officers. So we're not asking them to do an unduly burdensome task. It's not like a city of Chicago size, of Pittsburgh, even a smaller city like Pittsburgh, which is still a relatively sizable city. We're not talking about, thousands of officers. We're talking about 10 officers. We're asking them to have to do their job properly, because we feel in order to this lawsuit, part of the key point of this, what we want out of this lawsuit, right, is we want change. Isn't that the point? I mean, this isn't about money. They can't bring Antoine Rose back. This family will never be the same. They'll never be done grieving. They'll never be whole again. They've lost one of their stars, one of the lights of their life. And so we can't get that back. So no money would make that right. So what do they want? They want him to be remembered forever in a positive light, but they also want change, because they don't want future Antoine Roses to be killed at the hands of officers who aren't properly vetted, who aren't properly trained. So the reason I talked about Michael Roosevelt's behavior first, because I don't want to take the eye off the ball, which is we believe that his actions were criminally intended in that regard, because we think shooting an individual in the back 30 feet away is criminal. Now, we're also looking at, in a lawsuit, we're also looking at all of these theories of negligence, and you can have alternative theories. We think there's many theories of why there's liability, not just negligence. I'm saying why there are liability, why is there civil liability? And obviously, one of them is the unreasonable use of force, but the other ones are also these lack of procedures we think were approximate cause to allow this to occur. Because why didn't they know everything about Michael Roosevelt's past? And if they didn't, then they should have. So it's either they knew or they should have known what his past was, and he should not have ever been hired as a police officer, which I kind of alluded to this earlier when we talked a few weeks ago, maybe a month ago. That might come back to Pitt University later, because the University of Pittsburgh, who was his previous employer, they knew what his history was. They can't argue they didn't know, because it happened under their nose, and they discovered it, and they let him resign, is what we believe occurred. And we'll find out more. They let him resign, and they launched him softly out into the ocean as a shark ready to attack. They knew what he was. They knew what his character was.
Let me stop you there and ask for some clarity. Have you had the opportunity, and if you did say this, please forgive me for not catching it, do you know what his record was with the University of Pittsburgh Police?
So here's what we know. We know that there's already been two civil lawsuits filed by a firm here in Pittsburgh regarding with victims of Michael Roosevelt. We know also that the chancellor's, one of the highest ranking African-American official at the school, her son was beaten by Michael Roosevelt. That's what was the
example
that came crashing down to end Michael Roosevelt's career at Pitt. And, he beat the wrong person, right?
Got you.
He beat up someone who mattered. And so that individual was the one who uncovered this because when they reported that, allegedly, this is what people are saying off the record. And so to answer your question, we are close to having it. We don't have it yet.
Okay. The reason I asked is because you know as well as I do that in many instances, you're given an option to leave a job instead of having to answer the question, were you fired from your job? So that's why I wondered if you had insight into what his record was there and why he was actually terminated.
Right. Well, that's what we believe occurred was that this last time that he beat a chancellor's son, the secretary chancellor's son, we believe that was the straw that broke the camel's back, because when they went back and looked at that report, it didn't jive with what the footage was from his body cam. And then they realized that, oh my God, all these other reports where he was being accused of things that we dismissed, those were actual and they were not imagined. And so now we, like you said, we're going to let you have a resignation, but see, that's a problem. It's a problem that I want to change or help change, because there should be full disclosure. It's not like you're going to work at Valvoline.
Right.
You're going to go to the Gap. You're going to have a badge. You're going to have a gun. You're going to have a taser. You're going to have arrest power. You're going to be able to use deadly force. When someone goes to that kind of job, the future prospective employers should be able to look at a database or have full knowledge of what the previous employers know. And if they don't know, that's a problem. And if there's not policies in place that makes that a regular standard procedure, then that's what we hope this lawsuit will change, because that in itself will root out a lot of bad apples, because no one suffers greater. I mean, obviously the people that are the victims at the hands of these officers select few officers that are the bad apples. The officers that are working hard every day and putting their uniforms on and going into dangerous situations and running towards danger where we would flee it, those individuals are scrutinized so harshly based on the actions of these few officers. And so no one would want these officers screened better, more than they would, you would hope. And if it's not the case now, that's another change. I want officers to police officers. I want the good officers to say, and Wilmer, they know who they are. They work with them every day. I talk with officers all day long, every day. I'm a criminal defense attorney. I'm a personal injury attorney. I'm a civil rights attorney. I'm in the hallway with officers more than I'm with my own children some days. So, you know, they know who the bad eggs are. They understand who has the wrong disposition. They know who has the wrong attitude. They know who has the wrong malintent. And what I want from this lawsuit is I want those officers to start understanding that it's their responsibility to police those officers. And so between the vetting process improving and maybe having a community aspect to that vetting process, let's put one vote before you hire an officer to the community and see if they can do their research and have a say. Because maybe communities should have a vote before an officer is hired in their borough, and that vote should be considered. That way, it's on record. We objected and you hired them over our objection, and we told you X, Y, and Z about this officer. So these are some of the changes that we talk about when we talk about a civil litigation that we really can't get into in a criminal litigation.
Gotcha.
Criminal litigation is only whether or not the government can prove beyond a reasonable doubt that a crime was committed. You could have a lot of culpability and still win because maybe they don't prove it beyond a reasonable doubt. When I do criminal jury trials, I always tell the jury, you don't have to prove, the government doesn't have to prove this case beyond a mathematical certainty. And I get very close to the end of the bar of the court. And I say, but they got to get pretty darn close. And proof beyond a reasonable doubt means that you cannot have a doubt before you bring down that hammer and make that decision. Well, guess what? There's a lot of proof between zero and reasonable doubt. And what we're saying is that in a civil case, you only have to prove that there's clear and convincing evidence that the scales tip ever so slightly in your favor to prevail. And so it's a different standard in a civil than it is in a criminal arena.
My final question for you or just point of clarification, as I understand it now, Rosenfeld is now set for a formal arraignment on the 22nd of August. At his arraignment, the case will be assigned to a judge. He remains free on unsecured bond with electronic home monitoring, and that he is on unpaid leave from the East Pittsburgh Police Department. Is that the current status of Roosevelt?
You've explained it directly and accurately. So in Pittsburgh, we have the preliminary hearing, and then you'll have a formal arraignment where the charges are actually prepared into a bill of information. And at that state, at that status hearing, a judge is then assigned, and that from that point, a pretrial conference is established. And at this point, in cases like this that are specially assigned, a prosecutor already has the file. His name is Dan Fitzsimmons. He's a seasoned prosecutor. He's an excellent prosecutor. I believe he'll take this case very seriously. You know, that's an obvious, you know, concern of the family. They want this prosecution to be handled with the zealousness that every prosecution's handled.
Well, actually, I had said that that was my last question, but what you just mentioned was going to actually be my last question, which is, what is your sense with from the district attorney and the other members of his office, and what is the sense on the street?
Well, if you ask the district attorney's office has asserted and assured us that they are going to pursue this as zealously as they pursue any case. You know, the people in the community are concerned because, you know, when does someone get a criminal homicide and be released on an unsecured bond? You know, how does someone get in and out of a jail and get arraigned in a couple hours when our ordinary clients take 24 hours or 36 hours to get in and out of a jail? So the appearance of impropriety sometimes can be startling. I have to believe in the system. And I'm here as a spotter, you know, in a certain respect, because I'm not a direct litigant in that litigation. I'm just a civil attorney and handling the case that I filed in federal court. But I'm certainly watching, and I'm certainly safeguarding. And I hope the county detectives that are handling this case would handle this with decorum and handle it just like they would any prosecution.
Gotcha.
But, you know, in the end, you know, you do have officers prosecuting officers, and that's always a concern for everyone. But I have to hope that everyone will be on the up and up and be professional and act with decorum and do this according to the Constitution, you know, of Pennsylvania and the United States.
Attorney Fred Rabner, representing the family of Antoine Rose II, thank you so much for your time. Thank you for reaching out. And we look forward to having you back on the Critical Hour.
Always a pleasure, and thank you for discussing this with me.
You got it, Fred. Thanks, man. Have a good weekend. You're listening to the Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There's more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. So, the Senate sends a $717 billion defense bill to President Donald Trump for his signature. What does this mean, and where do we go from here? Well, to get some insight into this, as well as some other issues, we're going to turn to my next guest. He's a journalist and political analyst whose focus is on U.S. foreign policy and the global system of monopoly capitalism and imperialism. He is Caleb Maupin. Caleb, as always, man, welcome back to the Critical Hour.
Sure. Glad to be here.
So the Senate cleared and sent to President Trump a $717 billion defense policy bill aimed at building up the military and blunting Chinese foreign investment in telecommunications technology. The final vote was 87 to 10 in the Senate, and it was 351 to 66 in the House. This $717 billion includes $616.9 billion for the base Pentagon budget, $21.9 billion for nuclear weapons under the Department of Energy, and another $69 billion would be authorized to fund U.S. war efforts under the Overseas Contingency Operations Account. What message does this send around the world, and what does it say about our domestic politics?
Well, you'll recall that when Donald Trump was running for president, one of his criticisms of the Obama administration was the defense sequester and the cutting of the limited cutback in military spending. And Trump promised that he was going to increase military spending. And he seems to have very much done that. Furthermore, Trump is very open about the fact that he sees selling U.S.-made military hardware around the world and making money for military contractors and weapons manufacturers to be good business for the United States of America. So I don't think this really comes as a big surprise to anybody. Now, you know, every year there is a National Defense Authorization Act that's passed. What's particularly interesting about this year's is that there was some language attempting to distance the United States from Saudi Arabia in the bill. I don't know if you noticed that, but there was some attempt within the bill to say that Saudi Arabia should restrain its activities, something to that effect.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't really have the effect of limiting U.S. arms sales to Saudi Arabia at all. But there does seem to be an effort, you know, as the war in Yemen continues, as civilians continue to die in Yemen. It seems that in some policy circles in Washington, D.C., there is somewhat of a realization that this is bad PR for the United States to be so heavily involved in Saudi Arabia's atrocities in Yemen. So that was an interesting fact that was included. But other than that, this was a typical defense bill, the biggest military budget in the world, continuing to spend money while we cut social programs, cut back on social spending. This has been the grievance of left-wing activists and critics of U.S. foreign policy and domestic policy for many decades. You know, we can find money to kill people. We can't find money to feed people and give them health care. So I think we'll be hearing a lot of the same arguments from those critics as we've heard before. What is interesting is it seems like now these criticisms are in a strange situation with Trump being, you know, disliked by a lot within the political establishment who probably voted for this bill but are critical of Trump in some other ways. You have the Bernie Sanders opposition emerging within the Democratic Party and the rise of Democratic socialists and other forces that do like to raise this, this people's budget versus military budget issue. So I think this will play itself out a little bit differently.
So the president goes to North Korea, and he's talking to Chairman Kim Jong-un about denuclearization and more denuclearization. In fact, under the Obama administration, there was this discussion and apparently some dismantling of old nuclear weapons. And now there's $20.9 billion for nuclear weapons programs from the Energy Department. That, to me, is sickening.
Oh, indeed it is. And you'll remember that when Donald Trump received the endorsement of Bobby Knight, the basketball coach, campaign, Bobby Knight's endorsement was he said that Donald Trump is the kind of guy who would drop an atomic bomb. He compared him to President Truman, said it took so much guts to drop the atomic bomb on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and you ought to vote for Trump because he will drop the atomic bomb. I think most Americans were sitting there going, well, I would vote for a guy who wouldn't drop the atomic bomb. That's generally, you know what you would do. And with nuclear weapons, you know, as we increase spending on nuclear weapons, you have to ask yourself, you know, if we are ever in a situation where nuclear weapons are going to be used, there's a pretty good chance the human race won't be around for much longer after that. So is that really what we ought to be investing our money in? Because hopefully we'll never be using what we're investing our resources in. And then I don't think we're in the Cold War situation where people are talking about mutually assured destruction and, you know, an arms race and all of that. I mean, there have been big international efforts to make sure that thing doesn't escalate the way it did during the Cold War days. You know, we have the Non-Proliferation Treaty, and there are a lot of questions about, you know, why exactly we're moving in this direction.
So you mentioned the progressive side of the, particularly the Democratic Party, the whole discussion about guns and butter and so on and so forth. You had people such as John Garamendi, Democrat from California. He was on the record saying the bill pushes us even further and faster down the path to war toward a new nuclear arms race. Does it make us safer to have a low-yield nuclear weapon on one of our submarines? Probably not. but he voted for the bill. And then you have individuals such as you have some potential Democratic presidential candidates, Kamala Harris, Ed Markey, Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders. They all voted no in the Senate, but one could make the argument that their no vote was the safe vote for them politically because they knew the bill was going to pass anyway. So now as presidential candidates, they're able to make the claim that Barack Obama made when he was in the Senate, I didn't vote for the war. They're now able to say, I didn't vote for the bill. So on the one side, talk about the hypocrisy of a John Garamendi, and then is the analysis that the Harris, the Markeys, the Warrens, then the Sanders of the world, they took the safe route based upon political expediency.
Well, I mean, one could certainly argue that. I mean, if you look at it, I mean, when a bill is guaranteed to pass, a vote against it is something you can then stand up and put on your record. There's no question about that. You know, one thing you will notice that in the past we've seen Bernie Sanders take some interesting stands. Now, when they put new sanctions on Russia, there was this bill to put new sanctions on Russia, Iran, and new sanctions against Iran, Russia, and Syria, I believe.
Sounds right.
It was Iran, Russia, and North Korea. I'm sorry. And when this bill was passed, we actually saw Bernie Sanders as one of the few congressmen and senators to vote against it. And the reason he gave, he said he was for the sanctions on North Korea. He was for the sanctions on Russia, but he thought that moving away from the Iran deal was bad policy. And so we actually saw him, standing alone in one instance and actually voting against this sanctions bill on Russia that was really being really strongly pushed by the Democratic National Committee because they wanted to punish Russia for alleged meddling in the U.S. election. Now, Sanders said he agreed with punishing Russia, but he just didn't agree with Iran. But on paper, he voted against it. So that's something interesting to think about. But, you see all of this, and that at the end of the day, the bill did pass. And one thing that is interesting is Dennis Kucinich for many years would stand alone because he would vote against authorizing funding for continued military operations around the world. And he would say all these, Barack Obama, all these forces in Congress at that time that were saying that they were against the wars, they said they were against the wars, but they continue to authorize the funding. And the argument was, well, we have to fund them because, they're already going to be there.
Right.
But they have to have the military hardware and the supplies while they're over there.
Right. We can't have guys on the field with no bullets.
Yeah, basically that was the argument. So you have to fund it. You can be against the operation, but you have to fund it was the argument that you heard. But Dennis Kucinich stood against that and said, no, I'm not going to vote to fund the Iraq war. And that was a stand that he took, and he stood alone very, very courageously. But the interesting thing is, in more recent years, Maxine Waters, Barbara Boxer, I mean, some of these figures that were very, very critical of the Iraq war have really become very, very hawkish in terms of foreign policy. Some of the most outspoken critics of George W. Bush's wars are now the most outspoken advocates of U.S. military intervention around the world in a different context, and particularly pushing this hostility toward Russia, this idea that we should hate Russia, that Russia's meddling all over the world, Russia's coming to get us, we need to isolate Russia, we need to escalate support for the government of Ukraine, we need to escalate efforts to bring down the Syrian government. You're hearing a lot more hawkish tone from the Democratic Party. And furthermore, we're now seeing figures that have long been associated with Republicans and conservatism. I mean, James Comey, now that he's no longer FBI director, is giving the Democrats campaign advice on Twitter and urging everyone to vote for the Democrats, saying if you don't vote for the Democrats, you're not working in the interests of the United States, telling the Democrats to steer clear of Ocasio-Cortez and democratic socialism because they'll lose. We're seeing a lot of forces from the political establishment that were normally part of the right-wing military neoconservative interventionist faction now saying that Trump is some kind of liability and lining themselves up with the mainstream of the Democratic Party against Donald Trump.
Final question on this before we go into the break. And this thought just came to mind as you mentioned North Korea as part of that group that was going to be included in the sanctions. $21.9 billion for nuclear weapons. Could you see Kim Jong-un calling Donald Trump and saying, you know what, Donald, when you were here in Singapore, you didn't talk about building up your nuclear arsenal as you've been asking me to destroy mine. So I got to rethink our conversation.
I could see him saying that. I mean, I can think he would be perfectly justified in saying that. You know, and who would stop him from saying that?
We know no one in Korea would stop him from saying it. He can say what he wants to say. But no, I get your point. That's an ungodly amount of money. Well, here's the thing. I believe that budgets are numeric representations of priority. And so in these days and times, with infrastructure crumbling and homelessness and public schools being underfunded, and we're spending $717 billion on increasing our war footing, with almost $22 billion going to nuclear weapons. I don't have a word for it in my vocabulary that I can say on the radio.
Sure. And again, this is for something that, I mean, if we never built another nuclear weapon, but yet we ever used the arsenal that we had, we're in really dire straits as a species. So, you know, it's why build up something that you don't ever intend to use? That seems to not be logical, you know?
Right.
It'd be like, building a house that you're never going to live in. Why do that? You know, why invest money in a business that's never going to open? I mean, why build more nuclear weapons? Because if we're ever in a position to use the ones we already have, let alone some whole new arsenal, we're in a really bad spot.
Caleb Maupin, stay with me, please. You're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon, and it is Friday, so it's time for my panel. So along with my guest, Caleb Maupin, we're joined by author, political analyst, and host of the weekly Hutchinson Report on KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles and the Pacifica Network. His latest book is Why Black Lives Do Matter. He is Earl Ofari Hutchinson. Welcome back, Earl.
Dr. Leon, Wilmer, how are you?
I'm great. Caleb's with us as well?
Absolutely. Standing by.
The Pope declares death penalty unacceptable in all cases. Pope Francis has declared that the death penalty is wrong in all cases, definitive change in church teaching that is likely to challenge faithful Catholic politicians, judges, and officials in the United States and other countries who have argued that their church was not entirely opposed to capital punishment. Pope Francis said executions are unacceptable in all cases because they are an attack on the inviolability and dignity of the person. And the church also says it will work with determination for abolition of capital punishment worldwide. There are over 2,800 people who sit on death row in the United States, and I believe there are 14 executions that are scheduled for the remainder of 2018. What does this do to the politics, especially for Catholics and Christians? There are 22 states with Catholic governors, Governor Greg Abbott of Texas, Governor Pete Ricketts of Nebraska. Both Catholics they've presided over capital punishment in their states. In fact, Ricketts states that it won't matter to him. What does this do, if anything, to our politics going forward? Earl?
I grew up in the Catholic Church, and I have to confess, and I'm not making a pun when I say confess, that I'm still a practicing Catholic. Actually, I was a lapsed Catholic for many, 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 many years and came back to Catholicism. And I'll tell you why. A couple of reasons. But primarily because of this Pope. I like what I heard from this Pope. And I'm just talking about the death penalty, but a lot of things. His whole thing about wealth inequality, social justice, the things that he was going to emphasize, and also to an extent that he could, the reforms in the church, much needed. Now, I got all the cultural stuff, the abortion, men and women in terms of their role in the laity and the clergy in the church. I know they're still stuck in another millennium on that one. But I like the social justice part. But, by the way, it's not new in the Catholic Church. You've had cardinals and you've had bishops and you've had popes that have always, to one degree or another, not like the current Pope, but have always given some lip service anyway, and even in places in Latin America and other places, much more than that, in liberation, social justice, and a lot of the issues that we like to talk about and think that we are on the right side of the angels when it comes to that. So the death penalty, I'm not surprised, because in Catholic churches, you hear a lot of times priests, even before the Pope came out, made it official. You hear priests and you hear monsignors and you hear clergy of all sorts in various churches around the country. I don't know about Latin America, who we're talking about in the Western Hemisphere. They do talk about the death penalty and have talked about that and how they oppose that. The other thing, too, is the sanctity of life. Catholic Church is big on that. Catholics are big on that. So at least there's a consistency, because, as you know, they're opposed to abortion. So we've always said, wait a minute, be consistent.
Mm-hmm.
Oppose the death penalty, too. So at least in that sense, they've aligned the stars on that one, even though, again, we vigorously disagree with their positions on abortion, women, homosexuality, and all of that. And there are many Catholics, by the way, within the church that disagree, too. Now, having said that, what trumps governors in states that are Catholic, I mean, Catholic governors, but, in fact, the death penalty proponents, like one that you just mentioned? Well, you got to remember now, politics comes in. I mean, the Pope is over there thousands of miles away. You know, he's pontificating about what the doctrine should be. But at the same time, we got to run for reelection. We're conservative. This is our party. This is our party's position. We're pro-death penalty. And many of our constituents, voters, are pro-death penalty, pro-capital punishment. So it's a balancing act there. But in this case, governors that are conservative, very conservative, and pro-death penalty, it's not going to make much difference what the Pope says. They're still going to do what they want to do, because politics, again, supersedes everything.
Before I quickly go to Caleb, let me just say, like you, Earl, I am Catholic as well. I was, as a child, I was sentenced to do 1 to 12 years in Catholic school, and I had to serve all 12. There was no parole. But also, to your point about the governors, Abbott in Texas and Ricketts and the other 20 states, that to me, and I'll throw this to Caleb, that takes us back to 1960 and John Kennedy, when he was running for president, and people were asking the question, could a Catholic be president, because the Catholic United States president would be torn between two masters, honoring the Pope versus honoring the Constitution. So, Caleb, I throw the same question to you.
Well, I guess I'm the outsider here, because I grew up in the Protestant church. But you know,
we love you anyway.
Question regarding,
no, we absolved you.
Yeah. Well, regarding Kennedy, the interesting thing is, you know, there's a lot of talk about presidents' religion and such, but we've had two Quaker presidents. Both Richard Nixon and Herbert Hoover were members of the American Society of Friends. They were Quakers, and yet, especially Richard Nixon had no qualms about going to war. This is a church. Mm-hmm. Members will not serve in the military and all of that. And that often presidents and elected officials in general take actions that are contrary to their church's teachings. I know that George W. Bush was the governor of Texas for many years. He was a Methodist. And the Methodist Church is adamantly opposed to the death penalty. And before each execution, his pastor would call him and request him to not do it. And he would ignore it. And he oversaw many executions as the governor of Texas. The interesting thing about the death penalty in the United States, I will say, is that, you know, around the world, there are many countries that have the death penalty. I believe the overwhelming majority of countries around the world do not have the death penalty. But among the countries that have it, you know, you have countries that are very much in kind of, they see themselves in a state of war. You know, they're besieged, and the death penalty is almost, it's almost like serving a military purpose. If forces come in, you know, that are trying to overthrow us, you know, we will institute the death penalty. You know, if you are working with this terrorist group that's trying to bring down our government, you will die. And we can argue about the morality of it, but in terms of, you know, in terms of practicality, it serves a purpose. People are understanding that they will not associate with this terrorist group or whatnot, or they will die. But the way we practice the death penalty in the United States, it is not a deterrent whatsoever. You know, the individuals who get it must be a premeditated murder, right, or the killing of a police officer, and then they don't get it for maybe 20, 30 years after they commit their crime. They sit in jail for 3 decades waiting for the death penalty. And the kind of crimes that these people commit, the studies show that the states that have the death penalty tend to have higher rates of murder. And that really the kind of the individuals who go out and commit the kind of crimes you get the death penalty for in the United States, they don't really have an impact. They're not impacted. They're not thinking, oh, I'm not going to do this because I'm going to get the death penalty. It just doesn't have the impact.
No, and it doesn't, to your point, because in most instances, murder is not a rational act. And it is a act that is committed in the spur of the moment. I believe in most instances, the individuals that are involved in the heinous act know each other. So you are, in many instances, applying a rational actor standard, as in the death penalty is a deterrent to murder. You're applying a rational actor standard to an irrational actor.
Yeah, and it doesn't really seem to have a deterrent effect. And it almost takes on, for a lot of people, and I would say probably more Protestant folks, it takes on the aspect of almost a religious ceremony. You know, they believe that there needs to be, you know, some kind of, justice being carried out. And it almost serves a semi-religious purpose. They believe it must be done for kind of religious and not rational reasons. And in some cases where we see, like, you know, where there's an individual who's killed a police officer, and there have been instances in Texas where the police will then, you know, they'll have hotels rented out where they're watching it on closed circuit television in the hotel rooms, whole hotels full of police officers watching the execution of someone who's killed a police officer. And you really wonder, is this the kind of, you know, mindset we should really be promoting as a society? Should we be encouraging people to, you know, to seek revenge? Should we be encouraging people to take pleasure in the killing of other people? And that you almost wonder if, you know, we have so much of a problem with violence in the USA as it is, with, you know, mass shootings, with a lot of issues. Is the death penalty really helping us to be a safer country or not? And I think the overwhelming
answer is no.
It's the case that it's no, that it is not. And that ultimately this is creating an atmosphere in our society that is not healthy and leads to more of the problems that in theory the death penalty is meant to address but doesn't seem to be addressing.
I found the Poniff's declaration to be incredibly timely in that this past Tuesday, an Arizona man, Barry Lee Jones, had his conviction thrown out after spending, to your point, Caleb, 23 years on death row. His conviction was overturned, and in a 91-page order from the judge, they were ordered to either release him immediately or to retry him immediately. And I think they're waiting to see. Earl, you wrote a piece, "While all eyes are on SCOTUS, Trump busily packs the federal judiciary." You say the name Brett Kavanaugh will be a household name when the titanic fight over his nomination to the Supreme Court begins in earnest. Democrats will go to the barricades to paint him as a dangerous Antonin Scalia. But who knows the names such as L. Stephen Graz, Kyle Duncan, John Bush, Ryan Bounds, or Paul Maddy? The names people don't know because these are the lower court conservative justices that Trump has appointed. Take it from there, Earl.
Well, all eyes are on the Supreme Court. All eyes are on, and they always are. Anytime there's a vacancy on the court, anytime a president makes a nomination, especially the last 30 years when it's been totally, not only politicized, but polarized, it's an ideological, literally titanic battle between two parties and two ideologies. So there's been nothing different about Kavanaugh, just as it's been over the last decade or two with other picks, be they a Democratic president or Republican president, same thing. Now, what I've always found interesting is, again, 95% of the media and public attention is focused on the Supreme Court. But we know two things. When you really look and fine-tune it, what about the federal judiciary? You get 167 judges in the federal judiciary nationally. You know, it's a lot of judges. They make a lot of decisions. A lot of cases come before them. Very few cases, as we well know, ever make it to the Supreme Court. They die a natural death, a legal death, long before they get there. I mean, they cherry pick very few cases at the high court level. Most of the decisions really are at the appellate court level or the lower courts. What Trump has been able to do with, unfortunately, with them, I have to say this, an assist from the Democrats, you know, when they change the rules now, it used to be that if you had an appellate court, lower court nominee, you had the hearings, Judiciary Committee, and then you had the right to challenge. I mean, they could hold it up. There were a lot of maneuvers that the other party could do. So it wasn't just it wasn't a done deal. And a lot of, as we know, appellate judges, they were not confirmed. And we saw that continually during the Obama years when he couldn't get anybody on the court practically. So what happened was they changed the rules. He also, too, had senators in the state that also had the ability. Okay, we got a nominee from, let's say, Oregon. We don't like the guy or we don't like her. We don't like her politics. We don't like her ideology. We looked at their case studies and case law and ruling. We don't like them. And what we can do is we can, what they call, blue slip that. We can just say, no, we don't want them. And the Senate would have to take that up. They would have to take that into consideration. So time and time, oftentimes when a senator opposed it, basically what happened was it killed the nomination. You can throw that out now. Senators still can blue slip and say we don't like a particular nominee. But McConnell, as he's done in the past, he's ignored it. It's going to go ahead. They're going to get the nomination and the confirmation. What Trump has been able to do quietly with the aid of the Federalist Society, because this guy's a big dumb guy. He didn't know anything. The Federalist Society and the Heritage Foundation, they vetted all of these very carefully, vetted these potential judges. They know them. They look at their background, case history, their politics, ideology. They don't want any more Bork mistakes. They don't want that. They are very, very careful about who the list of judges they give to him. I mean, they're pristine ideologically as you can be. And also well-educated. They're young. They've got a good track record. In other words, they're very presentable and sellable.
And most of them, Kavanaugh is an exception, most of them don't have paper trails.
Don't have paper trails. But the fact of the matter is they're being confirmed. There's only been recently, Trump has nominated a lot of judges. He's gotten just about all of them confirmed to the appellate court, lower courts. They would have to be extreme in their views. Wilma, a paper trail.
Right.
In one case, they did find a paper trail with one of his nominees. And ironically, Tim Scott, GOP.
Tim Scott's the one in South Carolina that stood up and said no.
He said no, and as a result of Tim Scott saying no, it was no. But this guy was so, living out in space with some of the stuff that he had written. I mean, that was an easy call. But 95% of the judges, they have been confirmed. And here's the thing. They're not only looking, but one other thing, they're not only looking at judges, they're also looking at law clerks, too. Because remember one thing, they're vetting them, too, because they understand the way the trail goes up, law clerk one day, a potential judicial pick another day, and perhaps down the line, we have seen this, a SCOTUS pick.
Well, in fact, two of the candidates that were in the pool that Kavanaugh was in, two of those candidates were Kennedy clerks.
Kennedy clerks.
They had been Kennedy. Let me ask Caleb. So Caleb, where do we go with this? What can we do?
I think we're just seeing the standard continuation of a trend in the federal court system in the United States. It's moving in a right-wing conservative direction. During the 1960s, the federal courts in the 50s and 60s, the Supreme Court, the federal courts tended to play more of a liberal role, and they tended to enact progressive reforms that a lot of the population at that point might have been against, but in the name of the Constitution, they were able to pass progressive reforms. But let's remember that throughout most of U.S. history, it's been the opposite. The courts have been a mechanism for holding back progressive reforms. During the Roosevelt era, frequently when Roosevelt was trying to enact progressive reforms around the economy and such, we saw the Supreme Court step in to try and stop him. We saw him attempting to pack the courts. Lincoln had similar battles with the Supreme Court.
The switch in time that saved nine.
Yes, indeed. And
during the Roosevelt era.
Yeah, and that there is you know, that there is a kind of a back and forth. And, you know, at one point, the courts were playing a kind of a left-wing and progressive role, expanding civil liberties, and taking other moves around civil rights. And
the Warren Court.
But that's not the way the courts have normally operated throughout U.S. history. They've actually tended to function for the opposite purpose of kind of when a progressive reform was going to be enacted, kind of restraining it and saying, well, look, you can't do that, the Constitution. And a lot of, throughout most of U.S. history, progressive forces have seen the court as a barrier. Now, that changed in the 1960s, but I think we're going back to more of the way it's been, that the courts are a conservatizing force in U.S. politics.
You know, what's interesting, and I'll throw this out to either one of you wants to respond to it, is that we had the Warren Court, which was the most progressive court in the history of the country, and to Caleb's point, in the areas of civil rights, in the area of, that's where we got the Miranda decision from. Now everyone knows their Miranda rights. That's where we got the protections against what they call the fruit of the poisonous tree, which proceeds from illegal searches could not be admitted in court. Things along those lines. And then we get to the Rehnquist Court, we get to the Burger Court, then we get to the Rehnquist Court, and they chipped away at the civil liberty elements of progress. They, you know, that was the big thing. They wanted to give more power back to the police. They wanted to be sure, oh, well, if you make a mistake in a search, so long as it's made in good faith, we will allow those kinds of, so it was moving back to the right, but it was moving back to the right on the civil liberty side. Earl, we got about a minute.
I'll just say this. From day one in the 60s, the Warren Court is a starting point to understand this. The conservative right in this country, they made a decision, a very steady decision. We're going to roll it back. We're going to undo everything Warren did, civil rights, civil liberties, and on down, corporate power and so forth. And I have to tell you, so far, they've done a pretty good job.
They've done a very good job. Caleb, final thoughts.
Well, I think that this is continuing the trend. But I will also say that the Warren Court itself was a reaction to McCarthyism in a lot of ways.
Good point.
The fact that in the aftermath of the McCarthyism, many Americans, many rich and powerful Americans, saw the danger of power being concentrated in the hands of a few and red baiting and people being called before committees. And the Warren Court was very much a response from many sections of the U.S. political establishment to the fact that a certain section had tried to grab power and suppress others. And I think that there was an effort in a lot of circles of the ruling power not to let that kind of thing happen again. I think that's probably the key factor there.
Caleb Maupin, where can people find your writings?
Oh, CalebMaupin.com, CalebMaupin.com.
Earl Ofari Hutchinson, where can people find your writings?
The HutchinsonReport.net.
Hutchinson, HUTCHINSON, report.net. And you can also be heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, as well as the Pacifica Network, and your latest book, Why Black Lives Do Matter. Earl Ofari Hutchinson, as well as Caleb Maupin, as always, gentlemen, thank you for coming to the Critical Hour.
Thank you.
All right. Hey, folks, I got to give big shout out and thanks to the folks on Facebook. Thank you very much, as always, for watching and listening on Facebook. The comments are greatly appreciated. Showing the love on Facebook is greatly, greatly appreciated. You've been listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. Thank you all for allowing my voice into your space. I hope you were informed and enlightened. I look forward to talking with you all right here next week on Radio Sputnik. Peace and blessings. Be safe. Have a wonderful weekend. I'm out.